Hello, and welcome to Sobercast, where we provide AA speaker meetings and workshops in podcast format. We're an ad-free podcast, and if you enjoy listening, please help us be self-supporting by visiting Sobercast.com, look for the donate link, and drop a dollar or two into our virtual basket. We hope you enjoy the podcast. Have a great day.
Good morning. My name is Chet, and I am an alcoholic. My sobriety date's July 25th, 1984, and my home group is the College Park Triangle group that meets in Orlando, Florida on Thursday night at 7 o'clock. So if you all are ever in the Orlando area, I give you my last name so that if anybody uses telephone directories anymore, which I don't think happens, you can look me up and we'll make sure that you get to a meeting. Give you my disclaimer. You know, you get the disclaimer up front. This workshop or presentation took germ, took seed last convention in Jacksonville. And I had been looking for a way to understand the concepts. 10 years before, I was looking for a way to understand the traditions, and when I found a theme that I thought tied them together, it was helpful. And I thought that there might be a way to do that for the concepts so that I could come to understand the concepts a little bit better. And I'd had a couple of attempts that hadn't worked out very well. And so Ken, your delegate, and I were asked to do a presentation in Jacksonville on who runs AA. Well, of course, it's Ken and Chet, at least in Florida. I thought everybody knew that. So we did a presentation to prove it. And out of that came an idea that I had. And I talked to Beth about it, and she said, well, we could do that at the Southeast Regional in August. And I said, well, the problem with it is that as much as I've advertised this wonderful idea, nobody has asked me to do it. And so I have no idea whether it'll work, and more importantly, I have no idea how long it will take. And she said, well, you can come to the assembly and give it a run-through. So that's what this is. This is the initial run-through, and I have no pride of authorship. So if you all, when we're done, if you have any ideas for me of what worked or what didn't work, please share them, because this is truly a work in progress. That's the disclaimer. For me, It helps. When I sat down and read the concepts, I opened the book. I read it that way. Then I turned. I'm a fairly decent reader. I've made my living for the past 30 or 40 years reading. And they were pretty turgid for me. Turgid means indecipherable. But I think that it helps me to put it in context. So this introduction is the context. And it's old hat for... there are a few familiar faces in here this morning. Most of you are unfamiliar to me. But I know something about you. And what I know about you is that if you're in a concepts meeting at 8 o'clock on Saturday morning, you probably don't need to be in a concepts meeting at 8 o'clock on a Saturday morning. I am truly talking to the choir. I know that. But on the off chance that maybe there's somebody here who stumbled in by mistake, he just raised his hand. Let me just give a presentation of the context. We just celebrated the 75th birthday of Alcoholics Anonymous, June 10th, 1935. And that was the date that Bill Wilson had basically taken the program that we now know as Alcoholics Anonymous, the 12 steps that he derived from the Oxford groups, and he gave it to Dr. Bob Smith. And from June 10th, 1935, both of those men, the one who gave the program and the one who got the program, stayed sober for the rest of their lives. That was the first time in history that happened. So that is the date that we acknowledge and recognize as the founding of Alcoholics Anonymous. They immediately went out and tried to carry the message to others. And AA grew slowly. In the fall of 1937, Bill traveled back from New York to Akron and sat down with Dr. Bob and all the members of the Akron sobriety at that time, and they counted noses. They checked their progress and found that they had between 2 and 3 dozen people sober. And they realized that they had found the answer to alcoholism, which is kind of remarkable today, since the longest sobriety at that time was about 2.5 years. And the most remarkable thing about it is they were absolutely correct. But they sat down and said, what can we do? What can we do more to spread this message? And they immediately came up with the idea that they needed paid missionaries, because everybody had to get the program word of mouth, so people would have to give up their jobs and families to travel to, oh, the outlying areas like Chicago and Houston. They knew that they needed hospitals, because at least at the beginning, people had to be hospitalized for the effects of alcoholism, not the 28-day programs, but certainly the 7-day detox programs. And hospitals were not real fond of getting alcoholics in their beds, because alcoholics notoriously didn't pay for the services that they received. So we'd have to provide that. And literature. There had to be a literature that we could carry. And for that, they needed money. Well, what could they do to get money? Well, they could hit up rich people. Well, rich people got rich because they're not stupid. They wanted something for it. So the best way to hit up wealthy people is to give them a tax advantage. So they set up something called the Alcoholic Foundation, which was a charitable trust, so that wealthy people who gave money to Alcoholics Anonymous could get a tax deduction. And again, to make this palatable, because alcoholics are known, if you give them money, it will probably get spent at the nearest pub, they had to find a way to make it clear that if people gave money, it would not get dissipated. So the chairman, the treasurer, and the majority of the trustees of the Alcoholic Foundation were non-alcoholics. So that gave it a little bit of credibility. Unfortunately, it didn't work very well. Again, the wealthy were not real inclined to give a bunch of alcoholics money, even if there was this neat little foundation, this little charitable trust made up primarily of non-alcoholics. But the Alcoholic Foundation continued. 2 years later, the Big Book was published. Now, at the time the Big Book was published, Bill Wilson, Hank Parkhurst, owned 2/3 of the Big Book, the copyright. The other third was sold to individual investors. What happened was Bill and Hank set up a corporation called Works Publishing, except they really didn't set up the corporation. What they did was they went to a kind of an Office Max at the time, sort of a stationery store, and they bought a bunch of blank stock certificates and wrote Works Publishing, par value $25, and they went out and sold the stock to a non-existent company to people. But be that as it may, the ownership of the big book was in the hands of two individuals primarily and a bunch of others. And by 1940, they realized that the big book was a very valuable asset, and it really should not be held in the hands of individuals. And they looked around and they said, well, who can own this? You know, Alcoholics Anonymous was just this fledgling startup fellowship, but a fellowship is not a legal entity. So Alcoholics Anonymous could not own the big book. And they'd already decided that an individual shouldn't own the big book. And they looked throughout the landscape and said, well, who could own it? And there's this little foundation sitting over here, the Alcoholic Foundation, which is a legal entity. So over the next couple of years, the ownership of the big book, the copyright, came to be owned by the Alcoholic Foundation. Now, in the spring of 1941, the Saturday Evening Post led with an article on Alcoholics Anonymous, and that was a nationwide magazine. It's hard today to imagine the impact of the Saturday Evening Post in 1940, but it was kind of like getting a one-minute commercial at the Super Bowl. It was viewed by that many people at the time. And AA just mushroomed. We went from a couple of thousand at the most to 8,000 in 1 year. And more as AA grew, Bill turned over to the Alcoholic Foundation, these trustees, primarily non-alcoholics, the money matters of Alcoholics Anonymous. And everything seemed fine. Everybody was content with that. But Bill said, Bill looked again. Bill was very forward thinking. We were very fortunate to have a founder like Bill Wilson. The way AA was in the mid-1940s is kind of like a person in the middle with his arms outstretched. Now, the person in the middle was Bill and Bob. And on the right hand, they had the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, all the people who were coming into AA, all the groups that were starting to form, you know, San Francisco, Los Angeles, Portland, Newark, New Jersey, Miami. And on the other hand, you had the trustees of the Alcoholic Foundation, the people who owned the big book, where the money came, and the people who were starting to direct the world headquarters that Bill had established, this little headquarters where people would write in with questions about how to start an AA group in an area where one had never been started, and they'd get an answer based upon the experience that was being generated and kept. The problem was that the two hands never met. So you have Bill and Bob in the center, you have the trustees out on the left and the fellowship out on the right. And Bill said, everybody is happy with this right now, but it can't go on forever. There will come a time when Bob and I won't be here. So Bill thought, about this time he was also writing the traditions. The mid-40s was a very productive time. The traditions were written because AA was starting to develop some personality problems. Can you imagine personality clashes in a group of Alcoholics Anonymous? So he wrote the traditions to counteract those impulses that would tear us apart. And he also proposed a conference of elected representatives from all over the country, the United States and Canada, who would come to New York and sit down with the Board of Trustees. And he went through a series of ideas of how to do this. And it's very interesting. I have a series of letters between he and Jim Burwell over a period of years where he was throwing out ideas of how to make this work. And the reaction from everybody, both the trustees and the fellowship, was predictable. They didn't like it. We've never done it this way before. It got so bad that Henrietta Seiberling, who is truly one of AA's first friends, she was the one who put Bill and Bob together in the spring of 1935 at her home, very good friend of Alcoholics Anonymous. She started what was called the Orthodox Group, and they sent a letter out to all AA saying that Bill was suffering from delusions of grandeur and was grandiose. Okay, that's the kind of reaction. Now, what they were really opposed to was they thought that if you set up this service, this conference, what it would do, it would create political controversy. People would start politicking. They thought that it would centralize power and authority in New York, and we'd have sort of a central government. And they thought that it would cause great accumulations of money, which again would lead to authority and power struggles. But in 1948, something happened that changed the course. And that was, we found out that Dr. Bob was dying. That truly what Bill predicted was then going to happen within the next 6 to 12 months. And Bill writes about that last trip that he took to Akron. Bob was against the conference. Bob did not believe that the conference idea was a good one for the reasons I laid out. You know, Bob was known to say, keep it simple. He thought that this would not simplify anything. But Bill took that last trip to Akron and told Bob that it had to be done, that the simplification that we had lived in our adolescence wouldn't work into maturity. It would just cause more problems. Bob said, okay, let's give it a 4-year trial. Let's give it an experimental trial. And shortly after that, he passed away. And in April of 1951, the first General Service Conference was held in New York. And the theme of that conference was to serve, not to govern. In 1955, the experiment was deemed to be a success, and the International Convention in St. Louis made the General Service Conference that Bill had promoted and created. They made it permanent. In the 1960s, Bill wrote the 12 Concepts, and Nell Wing was his personal assistant and became our first archivist. Bill wrote the concepts in longhand on yellow legal pads, and what he tried to do was to pass on the spiritual lessons that he had learned in the past 25 years. So that's what we had. That was our world services as they came about. And the way I looked at this was, what we have, what runs AA is like a 4-cylinder engine. Okay? The first cylinder is the AA groups. The second cylinder is the General Service Conference, made up of the delegates from the groups and the trustees and staff. The third cylinder is the Board of Directors, the General Service Board, and the fourth cylinder is the service corporations, AAWS, AA World Services Incorporated, and the Grapevine Incorporated. And these four cylinders work together to run AA in the future. And the concepts are kind of like the timing belt in that engine. Now, a timing belt in a car is the thing that keeps the cylinders moving up and down in tandem or in relation to each other so that they all don't race up to the top at one time or race down to the bottom at the same time and destroy the engine. So the concepts tell us how our world services relate to each other. Who has the final responsibility and authority that was derived from the founders, Bill and Bob? Concept one, the final responsibility and the ultimate authority for AA service should always reside in the collective conscience of our whole fellowship. We need the world services. The keynote address at this year's conference was given by one of our Class A trustees who was rotating out, Bill Clark. And he talked about the ever-expanding circle of recovery, that each of us wants to increase the circle of recovery to the extent that we can in our cities, in our states, in our country, and in our world. And that's what world services essentially is about, is keeping those circles of recovery growing. And to do that, we need a coordinated public relations policy. We need literature, and literature is now being translated into more and more languages. I think the big book at the last count was in 58 languages, and there are several more in the works right now. So that a child is being born today can receive recovery no matter what language they happen to speak at birth. And that's our responsibility. And if we want to do that, although the individual groups are the ultimate authority, they can't do it. There needs to be a way to harness that. There are roughly 60,000 groups in the United States and Canada, 1.5 million members. How in the world can they get together and create this world service that we need? Can't do it. So they have to delegate their authority. And who do they delegate it to? Well, to their delegates. Concept two, the General Service Conference of AA has become, for nearly every practical purpose, the active voice and effective conscience for our whole society and world affairs. Bill and Bob could not transfer their authority to the board. The Alcoholic Foundation, at the time, we now know it as the General Service Board. For the most part, these are self-selected individuals. 99.44% of the members of AA could not tell you who the trustees of the General Service Board are. Bill and Bob could not turn it over to them. We just said that they couldn't turn it over to the entire group, so they had to find a smaller segment, a smaller part to turn it over to, and so it was the conference. But the conference only meets once a year. How can you run a worldwide service organization meeting once a year? You can't. So what do you have to do? Well, we have the General Service Board. The General Service Board meets 4 times a year. So the concept 6 and 7 flesh out the relationship between the conference and the Board of Trustees. Obviously, the conference delegates to the Board of Trustees much of the World Services operation. Concept 6 says, on behalf of AA as a whole, our General Service Conference has the principal responsibility for the maintenance of our World Services, and it traditionally has the final decision respecting large matters of general policy and finance, But the conference also recognizes that the chief active and responsibility in most matters should be exercised by the trustee members of the conference when they act as the General Service Board of Alcoholics Anonymous. Okay. So you have the conference, the 93 delegates, plus the trustees, plus the staff members meeting once a year, delegating to the Board of Trustees, the 21 trustees, the next level of policy. In doing this, we give the trustees a tremendous amount of authority because they need it. The Board of Trustees is responsible for all our publications, our literature, our grapevine, our public relations, our banking, the investment of the reserve fund, which right now stands about $9 million, and they are the guardians of our traditions. They have a tremendous responsibility, and so we have given them a tremendous amount of authority. So now we're talking about the Board of Trustees, and we're talking about the General Service Conference. How does the conference and the Board of Trustees share their duties? Concept 7. The conference recognizes that the charter and bylaws of the General Service Board are legal instruments, that the trustees are fully empowered to manage and conduct all of World Service affairs for Alcoholics Anonymous. It is further understood that the conference charter is not a legal document, that it relies instead upon the force of tradition and the power of the AA purse for its final effectiveness. We talked about in the history of how this came about, there was a need to have a legal organization, whether that be a corporation, whether it be a charitable trust that is recognized in the law. There is a need to have something, some entity that is accountable and can enforce asset rights. And Bill talks a lot in these concepts about something he calls legal authority and ultimate authority. And as I read the concepts through it, there is a tremendous amount of checks and balances. The idea that we're giving responsibility on the one hand, and therefore we're giving authority on the other, yet it is not unlimited. So we're just like in Congress and the President and the Congress and the Supreme Court, there is this idea of checks and balances, which implies a certain amount of tension. And Ken and I were talking about this last night, that there has been a certain amount of dynamic tension that's implicit in our world services and in the direction of our world service. The trustees have the complete legal power over the funds and services. They have to. You know, you can't open a bank account in the name of Alcoholics Anonymous. You can open a bank account in the name of the General Service Board of Alcoholics Anonymous, a nonprofit corporation, and we have to. But the conference always has the superior power. Isn't that interesting? I always thought the upside down triangle, just a remarkable, I fumble for the word, just a remarkable concept. That's little c concept. Alcoholics Anonymous is probably one of the most unique organizations in history. It is truly almost purely a service entity, pure service. Our fifth tradition says what? Our primary purpose is to carry the message to the alcoholic who still suffers. Who carries the message? Who's we? the groups and the individuals. And so you look at the upside down triangle. Who is at the top? The groups and the individuals. The people who are carrying the message are the ultimate authority. What other organization has that? So when we say the conference always has superior power, it is the groups through their elected representatives, primarily, who have the ultimate power. The way the conference is set up, last year, this year, there were 131 members. 93 of them are elected delegates from the areas in the United States and Canada. The conference, by two-thirds vote, can pass an action that is binding on the General Service Board. 93 is more than two-thirds of 131. I'm not a good mathematician. I couldn't tell you real quickly what two-thirds is, but 93 is more than that. What that means is that the delegates, the elected representatives of the groups in the United States and Canada, can take any action without the concurrence of anybody else. That is the ultimate authority, the superior power. The groups and the conference, if the trustees, the ones who meet four times a year, the ones who are the primary architects of our policy in the future, if the conference does not like what they're doing, they can cut off the funds. They can even reorganize the Board of Trustees. But it's this wonderful tension between the ultimate authority and the legal power. The selection of the trustees was changed. From the beginning, the trustees selected themselves. And they were basically New York business people connected with the... They were wonderful friends of Alcoholics Anonymous. Jack Alexander, the man who wrote the Saturday Evening Post article that caused the growth in AA, was a Class A, a non-alcoholic trustee on the General Service Board. You know, Frank Amos, one of the first people who came from the Rockefellers and talked to Dr. Bob in Akron, was a Class A trustee. We've just had wonderful, wonderful friends. But 99 and 44, 100% of the fellowship didn't know who they were. And when the conference was created by Bill and another Class A trustee, Bernie Smith, who was a lawyer, one of those wonderful people who is so important in our history, and Bernard Smith and Bill basically wrote the whole idea of how this conference works. There was a young lawyer in their offices, in Bernard Smith's offices, and his name was Michael Alexander. And Michael Alexander became one of the Class A trustees. He became the chairman of the Board of Trustees. And Michael died this year, I believe in March. And so our history, those people who are there and so important to us, are, if they're not all gone, there are not many left. And so the future of AA is up to us. We have to carry on. But one of the changes that Bill made was that the trustees no longer were totally self-selected. Bill established the fact that the trustees could not be selected by the groups because the groups really didn't know who was needed, what skills were needed. The trustees were aware of what jobs needed to be done. So they were given the initial task of nominating future trustees, but the final decision of whether or not a trustee, alcoholic or non-alcoholic, would serve on the Board of Trustees was left to the conference. So the conference was, again, put in a position of responsibility over the Board of Trustees. Now, the trustees do have tremendous power. The trustees can actually veto conference action in a very few instances. For example, if the conference acted against its own charter, the Board of Trustees would have to step in and say, no, you can't do that. And they have to do that because of their position as the legal entity that the world recognizes. The trustees can spend less than the conference budgets. If the trustees in their fiscal oversight say, no, the conference is spending too much money and it's not fiscally prudent, they can spend less. Interestingly, they can't spend more. And if unforeseen plans, remember I said the conference meets once a year, the trustees meet four times a year. If a plan that seemed really good in April becomes unworkable in September because of events that nobody could see, the trustees have the responsibility and the authority to say, no, we're not going to go forward. That would be imprudent under changed circumstances. So I spent a long time talking about the Board of Trustees, but they only meet four times a year, which is four times more than the conference, but still four times a year ain't much. How do you run a worldwide service operation meeting four times a year? They don't. So what does the Board of Trustees have to do? Delegate. The Board of Trustees has to delegate some of their responsibility to allow this operation to go on a continuous basis, what I call 24/7, 365. Who do they delegate to? The service corporations, AA World Services Incorporated and the Grapevine Incorporated. So concepts 8 and 11 clarify the relationship between the General Service Board and the service corporations. Concept 8 says the trustees of the General Service Board act in two primary capacities. With respect to the larger matters of overall policy and finance, they are the principal planners and administrators. They and their primary committees directly manage the affairs. B, but with respect to our separately incorporated and constantly active services, the relation of the trustees is mainly that of full stock ownership and custodial oversight, which they exercise through their ability to elect all directors of these entities. So what we have is our next two cylinders, the board and the service corporations. The board must devote itself to the larger questions of policy and finance, group relations, and leadership. They cannot deal with the day-to-day operations of the World Service Office or the publishing corporations. They can't manage the detail, and it has to delegate something Bill called the executive function. Now, when you read the concepts, there are two things that Bill talks about repeatedly. He talks about the policy formation function and the executive function. And in the beginning, they tried to combine both of these into the General Service Board. Well, at the time, it was called the Alcoholic Foundation. It's an interesting story. The Alcoholic Foundation, in 1951, when the first conference was formed, the cylinders were, as I said, except it was the Alcoholic Foundation as the legal entity. They thought that foundation sounds kind of paternalistic, you know, like we're asking for charity from a foundation, and they didn't like it. So in 1951, they proposed that the Alcoholic Foundation's name, but not its organization, be changed to that of the General Service Board. And 3 years later, the name was changed. There was a lot of debate over a period of years over a simple name change. But the Bill made it very clear that the committee system doesn't work to run an organization. You know, with a committee, you don't have a single head. You don't have a single responsibility. It's not clearly defined. And so when they came to set up this this little engine that I've been talking about, Bill made it very clear that the executive function, the day-to-day operations, had to be separated from the idea of this overall policy. So concept 11 says that while the trustees hold final responsibility for AA World Service Administration, they should always have the assistance of the best possible standing committees, corporate service directors, executive staffs, and consultants. Therefore, the composition of these underlying committees and service boards, the personal qualifications of the member, the manner of their induction into service, the systems of their rotation, the way in which they are related to each other, the special rights and duties of our executives, staffs, and consultants together with the proper basis of the financial compensation of these special workers will always be matters of care and concern. Bill emphasized the importance of our staff. You know, these are the people that Bill said most people identify AA with, because if a member from an outlying area had a question about how their group should operate, and they pick up the phone and they call the General Service Office in New York, they're not going to talk to a delegate. They're not going to talk to a trustee. They're going to talk to a staff member. And so these are the people who we come to identify with Alcoholics Anonymous. And so who they are and how they operate and work is very important. And Bill lays that out in Concept 11. He talks about reasonable compensation. There's nothing about cheap labor that's spiritual. Cheap labor usually gets you a bad job. It also causes discouragement among the workers because there's this feeling that I'm being paid what I'm worth. I'm not being paid very much, so this organization must not think I'm worth very much. Rotation. All of the staff workers rotate, usually on a yearly basis, and the reason for this is in case of an emergency, anyone could do any job. We would never be in the position where there, through a death or a resignation or an illness, we would be left with a vital job and nobody capable of doing it. So we have a constant rotation of qualified people who become more qualified. And finally, these workers, these staff workers, need to have full participation. Many of them are actually made members of the General Service Conference, and they have a vote on the policy matters. In this concept, Bill talks about money a lot, and he talks about the fact that there will come a time where there may be a move to consolidate, to put together some of these separate functions, and he warns against it. Money leads to power, and if you start to have a concentration of money, you will start to have a concentration of power. Consolidating operations always leads to more money and power. He points out that the work of AA World Services, the publication, is primarily financial. Doesn't that sound strange? The publishing company is mostly a financial company, but the point is that most of our literature has already been written. In fact, our probably our most important piece of literature was written in 1938. Okay. So mainly what the publishing company does is it publishes and then disseminates literature. Grapevine, however, is a very creative process. Every month, a magazine has to be created, published, and disseminated. So he was very, very strong on keeping these separate. And the reason I bring that up is tomorrow at your business meeting, Ken is going to disseminate a questionnaire that is being done. Grapevine, it's no secret that the Grapevine is in crisis. And a lot of discussion about how to keep it afloat, how to keep it financially viable. And I am starting to hear some talk about consolidating the Grapevine with, the general service funds as opposed to separate funds. And in that discussion, I would encourage people to read the full concept that we're talking about here, because we may ultimately decide through our collective conscience that it needs to be done, but there are some warning signs already done. So does the individual matter in this little machine? Concept 9 says good service leadership at all levels is indispensable for our future functioning and safety. Primary world service leadership, once exercised by the founders, must necessarily be assumed by the trustees. No matter how wonderful a structure we have, and I think we've got a really neat structure, it takes people to make it work. You can have an empty shell, and it's not going to carry our services very far. And good leadership starts with the GSRs, starts with the DCMs, and the delegates. They are the link between the groups and the world service. Personal ambitions need to be set aside, grudges and controversies forgotten. Who are the best qualified people? In Concept 9, Bill includes an article that he wrote in the Grapevine called Leadership, an Ever Vital Need. Leadership, not bosses. We need leaders, not bosses. Leaders are able to lead by example rather than authority, rather than mandate. And the other thing, surprisingly, that Bill writes about is vision. Because we think, oh, we live 24 hours at a time. But not on the world service level if we want to keep our circles of recovery expanding. Leadership requires someone who can look to the future, see what will be needed to further carry our message, and have an idea of how to get there, that they can communicate and get people excited to come behind. Those are the kind of leaders that we need. So we have our little motor. We have our four cylinders, the groups, the conference, we have the trustees, and we have the service corporations. What makes them run? The second theme in the concepts is something called delegation. AA has had a history of gradual delegation throughout. In the beginning, in 1937, those first few members in Akron and New York delegated to Bill and Bob the creation of something that never existed at the time. Bob later delegated to Bill the primary carrying responsibility because most of the things that were needed were in New York, and that's where Bill was. So Bob said, well, you carry the water on this one. Bill and Hank Parkhurst later delegated to the Alcoholic Foundation the ownership of the Big Book and the financial matters. So what does delegation entail? What are the possibilities? Concept 3 says, to ensure effective leadership, we should endow each element of AA, the conference, the General Service Board, and its service corporations, staffs, committees, and executives with the traditional right of decision. Okay. You know, you can have all the nifty little charters and bylaws, and they fit into this service manual, but if you tried to write out everything that every person had to do to carry our worldwide message, you'd need about 7 Miami phone books, and it wouldn't be enough. So we give people this thing called this right of decision. When you delegate, there are essentially three options. One is total freedom to act any way you choose. Okay, we give it to you, go do it, don't bother us with it anymore. The second one is total definition of authority in action. Like I say, that would require phone books. And the middle ground is where we come down to this right of decision. It's freedom when acting within the scope of defined responsibilities to decide when to act and when to consult. But there is always a duty to report. Legally, the groups could instruct their delegate. You could tell Ken or I, prior to conference, we instruct you to vote this way on this issue. But that would go against the whole idea of trusted servant. It would go against the idea that the delegate from an area is representative of the area, but acts for AA as a whole. And so when the delegates get to the conference, they take the input from their area, but they also listen to the delegates from all of the other areas in the United States and Canada and get their input. And this right of decision allows them to listen and say, well, you know, for the good of AA, I believe that I ought to go against what my area has told me they want to do. But then there is the obligation to go back to the area and report and say, I know this is what you told me, but here's what I heard that caused me to believe that that's not for the best. And the right of decision allows us to do that. The next question is who to participate. We've talked a lot about trustees. We've talked a lot about delegates. Do only the trustees and the delegates count? Concept 4 says at all responsible levels, we maintain a traditional right of participation, allowing a voting representation in reasonable proportion to the responsibility that each must discharge. Bill learned this lesson historically because initially, when he was in New York as the founder, and the Alcoholic Foundation owned the big book and had the power over all money matters, they had ongoing discussions. I mean, you know, World Services did not appear in 1951. It had been ongoing. Bill started World Services back in 1940 when he opened a little office in New York with a secretary. And it gradually grew. But in the middle 40s, when all of this was coming to a head, Bill would try to take his assistant, his staff assistant, in, and the Board of Trustees wouldn't hear her. And he said, this is the person who knows more than anybody because she's been working with it day in and day out, but they won't allow her to participate. So Bill had this idea of participation that he incorporated into the concepts. If you're responsible, then you get a vote in proportion to what you are. I went through this. My first service outside of my home group was in our intergroup, our central office. And at the time, we had a office administrator, a paid staff position. And there was a lot of talk about whether or not the office administrator, what was the function of the office administrator? How did they fit into the central office? And what we came to, I spent 5 years as either vice chair, chair, or trustee. And so this conversation went on over a period of years. My position was that using the eighth tradition, that we should never be professionalized carrying the message, that by paying this office administrator, we took them out of the service structure, so therefore they should not have a vote. That only people who were carrying the message as part of their recovery should have a vote. Now, what that tells you was I didn't know squat about the concepts. You know, I'd learned a little bit about the traditions, but the concept, this was about 10 years away. If I had known something about the concepts, this concept answers that question. You know, and I apologize. I was wrong. Are you taping this? Don't delete that part. Concept 10, each service responsibility should be matched by an equal authority, the scope of such authority well defined. Again, in another concept, Bill talks about this idea of operational responsibility must have the authority to carry it out. And he talks about ultimate authority versus delegated authority. And I got to tell you, if you sit down and read this, it can get kind of murky. But let me just suggest this. Delegated authority is, I give you the responsibility to do an action. Therefore, I give you the authority to carry that action. It is counterproductive for me to say, okay, I'm going to give you the responsibility, but here's how I want you to carry it out. I want you to make this phone call on Tuesday at 3 o'clock. On Wednesday at 4 o'clock, I expect you to be, you know, that's not giving responsibility. That's just directing. So there's a tremendous amount of delegated authority throughout the concepts, throughout all of the concepts, from the conference to the board, to the board, to the service corporations. We have it. One of the things I thought about was one of my beginnings to service was when I chaired the 2000 state convention. This idea of giving somebody a job to do and then letting them do it. But on the other hand, as the chair, I had just signed on for about an $85,000 personal liability. So if this thing didn't go right, you know, it could bankrupt me and my family. So I took the position that I had the ultimate authority to, especially on money matters, to correct that if I had to. And that's the word that I came up with to get this idea of ultimate and delegated authority. Ultimate authority is primarily corrective authority. We normally don't see the difference between ultimate authority and delegated authority. It works very smoothly. It just works. You have a great state convention, and everybody goes home and says, wonderful. And there was money left over to pay all the bills and to put into the service structure. Where you see it is when it's not working. When somebody exceeds their authority. When somebody doesn't do the job. Then you have to have somebody who can step in and correct it. So that's why I say, to me, ultimate authority primarily is corrective authority. The groups delegate to the conference, but if the conference deviates, the groups can elect new delegates. The groups can withhold funds. It's a tough way to do it, but it can be done. The conference delegates to the trustees, but if the trustees deviate, the conference can reorganize the board. The board also delegates to the service corporations, but if they deviate, they can reorganize the service corporations, they can replace the directors, and they can withhold operating funds. And the fact that people know that there is this ultimate authority is a good check to know that you don't need to do it. Okay? The fact that as Ken said, the fact that the sheriff is in town keeps us within the bounds. What did I just talk about? 10. Now, what if somebody truly disagrees with a decision or the action? I'm aware of that. What if somebody truly disagrees with the decision or action? Concept 5. Throughout our structure, a traditional right of appeal ought to prevail so that minority opinion will be heard and personal grievances receive careful consideration. If you feel that something's not being done right, you have an obligation to render a minority opinion because minorities are often right, and we are obligated to listen to the minority because quite often they have the germ of truth within them. I want to finalize and finish with the final concept. What about the objections that Dr. Bob and others had to setting up the conference? Remember, they thought that it would encourage politics and rivalries, it would create a government centered in New York, and it would start a large treasury which could lead to dissension, argument, and concentration of power. In that regard, listen to the 12th concept. The conference shall observe the spirit of AA tradition, taking care that it never becomes the seat of perilous wealth or power, that prudent operating funds and reserve be its prudent financial principle, that it place none of its members in a position of unqualified authority over others, that it reach all important decisions by discussion, vote, and whenever possible, substantial unanimity, that its actions never be personally punitive nor an incitement to public controversy, that it never performs acts of government, and that like the society it serves, it will always remain democratic in thought and actions. The 12 warranties and our 12 traditions are our protections against needless errors and against our natural human temptations to wealth, prestige, and power and the like. And if we follow those, the legacy that our founders left us will be continued into the future. So thank you all very much.
Thanks for listening. I hope you enjoyed the podcast. Sobercast is ad-free, and we'd like your help in order to keep it that way. So if you'd like to help us be self-supporting by pledging a dollar or two a month, visit Sobercast.com and look for the donate links. Thank you very much.